Hello and welcome to the Smart Beauty Podcast. I'm your host, Viola Levy, beauty journalist and founder of copy-led branding agency, Smart Beauty Creative. We're here to create your brand voice and craft the story behind it. Today, I'm incredibly excited to be joined by Millie Kendall OBE, serial entrepreneur and CEO of the British Beauty Council. She's one of the most influential voices driving change in the beauty industry today. Millie has been a force in beauty for over three decades, championing inclusivity, transparency, and positive messaging across the industry. Through her work with the British Beauty Council, Millie advocates for a beauty landscape that not only celebrates diversity, but also supports the unique needs and experiences of people at every stage of their lives. In our conversation, we'll delve into some critical questions around aging and representation in beauty, a topic I know Millie is passionate about. We'll explore the industry's shifting attitudes towards aging, the rise of pro-aging messaging, and the way brands can genuinely support all ages instead of reinforcing stereotypes. Millie will also share her insights on the booming menopause care market, the challenges women face, and the council's role in promoting beauty standards that empower rather than limit. Millie, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. I hope I live up to your expectations.
Of course. So how has the beauty industry's approach to aging changed over the past decade in your experience? And what do you think has driven this shift?
I mean, I think, and I hate to say this, but I think it's a lot of it is commercial, really. And I think that a lot of the larger companies adopted it reasonably soon when they realized that the spending power was with the sort of over 40s.
Yeah.
I think that there is disposable income. There is younger people are less wealthy than older people at the same age. I think that there is, we used to think disposable income was with the sort of young 20-year-olds who were still living at home because people lived at home longer. Mm. And so they had more money to spend, but actually that sort of shifted probably about maybe at the turn of the century, it's a weird thing to say, when it became very apparent that the sort of over 40s, over 50s, over 60s, people were living longer and actually they were the ones that held the wealth. And so there was a lot of talk, you know, 20 odd years ago about how the beauty industry should engage with those women that were a little bit older, that had more money to spend. Mm. And I think that, so you see a lot of advertising, people like Andy McDowell, who has long been a face of in beauty campaigns, who is now still the face in beauty campaigns, but with her beautiful grey hair, or Jane Fonda, who's been a beauty icon for, you know, decades and decades and decades, still, you know, walking the red carpet or the catwalk and still being the face of beauty campaigns. So I think that as cynical as it sounds, the shift is very commercial. Mm. And it's not necessarily always based on the needs of the older consumer. It's based on the fact that we've got the money.
No, definitely. And there's still kind of these ageist stereotypes that the beauty industry has been criticized for perpetuating. I mean, how do you think that we can move forward from that? Because we still see like the term anti-aging everywhere. And like there was an advert I saw on the tube the other day, like, you know, this is how you look 21 or something like that. And I was like, seriously, this, you know, 2024? Yeah. How do you think moving forward?
Yeah, I think the interesting thing is that we're all chasing the fountain of youth, aren't we? So, and I think that the, whatever you call it, we are all still looking back on pictures of ourselves thinking, wow, I looked happier, healthier, younger, blah, 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 you know, in those pictures when I was in my 20s. But life was very different back then. You hadn't experienced all the stress. I don't know if that's something that will change really overnight. I think it's about having a combination of both. I know for a fact that I accept myself much better now than I did back then. I think that while I may not look as young as I did when I was in my 20s, I'm much more confident and comfortable in myself. So I think it's about, and I actually think the wellness industry might be the key to this, Because it might not be how you look, it might be more about how you feel.
How you feel, yeah.
And that might, and that might not be about whether I still get out of bed and my hip hurts in the morning, and that's not pleasant. And that is part of aging. But I'm much fitter. I exercise more. I'm less nasty to my body. I'm more appreciative of the nooks and crannies and the wrinkles and the flab and the skin elasticity, and I'm kinder to myself. And I do think that the wellness industry will play a big part in this. And it's not just about the supplements and stuff like that, albeit that I think that that will be a part of it. I drink my Simproof in the morning. I take a tablespoon of the most disgusting sea moss before I've even drunk a cup of tea. I only have one coffee a day. I do Pilates and I have a trainer and I play tennis and I'm active. I still go out in the evenings, but I'm just kinder to myself. And I think that that's where we'll strike the balance. I do not think that anybody will ever be able to tell somebody of my age not to, that you shouldn't want to look youthful. I
No.
just don't think that's a reasonable thing to say. I look at those pictures and I think, my God, I was hot when I was 20.
I think
But
for
I'm 27, so it's like I have to figure out a way of feeling hot now, not worrying so much about how I look.
I think it's about just looking fabulous for your age, isn't it? I think that from my perspective, I'm about to turn 40, and I think it's just about looking. I don't want to look 21, but I just want to look less knackered. Like I've got a toddler, and I think I've aged about 10 years in the last like
Yeah,
18.
wait till that toddler gets to their teens, then you look knackered. Let me tell you.
Oh my gosh, don't
I
tell me
thought
that.
having young kids was exhausting. Having teenagers that go out at night and then you're at 2 o'clock in the morning, you're like, where the hell are they?
Oh my gosh,
That's stressful.
got
Well,
that.
it's all stressful, actually. Having children is stressful. But
Yeah.
yeah, I totally get it. Yeah.
But I think that, like you say, with the wellness industry, it's about kind of products that make you feel good as opposed to, it's more about feeling good as opposed to looking good. And I find if I feel better in my body, I feel better about my body, if that makes sense. So if like, I hit the gym, it's not to look like J-Lo, it's to just, if I, like, after a run, you feel amazing. And then I kind of have a better relationship with my body as a result. Do you kind of see more people leaning towards that, if that makes sense?
I do. And also things like sleep, like things like as I've gotten older, I mean, I don't know why, but in my 20s, I thought not sleeping was like the coolest thing ever. Now it's like I'm in bed. But the other night, because of the election, I went to bed like 1 o'clock in the morning, woke up at 5. I had 4 hours sleep. I mean, I look like I've been run over by a vehicle. I think that, sleep, exercise. Oh, sorry, my phone keeps trying to. I don't know. I need to
Oh
put my
no.
phone on disturb. That's another thing. The stresses of phone, right? All of that,
For
computer,
sure.
phones, constantly being on, all of that kind of stuff. It's distressing, and I think that exercise and sleep are really important. I really do think that.
No, 100%. So hopefully that kind of feeds into this sort of pro-aging message that we're trying to, move towards. I mean, do you think that, the companies that are doing it is sort of genuine, or do you think it's just another kind of marketing ploy at the moment?
I think there'll be a combination. I think there'll be some people that are really, really genuine. I mean, I'll say like, IIIA, I think are really genuine, and I think that actually how they integrate internal well-being and the outside physical stuff, I think is really amazing. And I think that, and actually just having and going back to that company particularly, because I've sort of spent a lot of time with them, and I think that I mean, they call their business, I think they refer to it as active aging. And I think that how, and actually their products and their treatments and how they kind of integrate inner health and outer well-being, I actually think it's good for young people as well, because a lot of it's based on gut and microbiome. So I think that some businesses absolutely genuinely are really promoting age and well-being. I think that some businesses will jump on it, the bandwagon,
Of course.
and to commercially gain from it. But we tend to sniff it out eventually. Those businesses that are, that aren't genuine, that don't have, I call it a backbone, where they don't have that sort of the genuine,
It's not part of their DNA of their.
the right ethos or whatever. It's shallow, and we sniff it out eventually. They don't last. I mean, they might make money, but they don't last.
They frame it as a choice. Well, you don't have to do this, but if you want to, here are the products. And it feels a disingenuous.
Yeah. I mean, listen, the fact is, they go again back to the fact that despite the fact that we're in a business where we feel as people that work in the industry that we're for the greater good, and we're helping people's well-being, and we're helping them to feel confident and wonderful. The fact is, we are part of an industry that sells product to consumers. So we are in a commercial environment. So people are always going to try and take advantage of that.
For sure. And I think there's always going to be that toxic element to
That's
try
in
and
everything. That doesn't That's in the food industry, that's in the fashion
100%.
industry, that's in the real estate industry. When you want to see a flat and then you get 50,000 estate agents calling you every
Yeah,
5 minutes.
they're texting and yeah.
It's like everyone's trying to sell you something. So we just have to be sort of almost emboldened to sort of say, look, this is what consumerism is about. We're living in the 21st century where every single thing we touch, my water bottle, is about trying to flog me something. It's just the way it is. We have to be bolder than that, and we have to be stronger than that,
For
and say, I'm
sure.
not going to buy into it. So, that's for us to manage, really.
Definitely. And at the same time, we're talking about pro-aging, but then there's a scary number of like young people getting like lip fillers and Botox and injectables. And I know that you with the British Beauty Council are trying your best to help regulate that.
Yes.
So there's more sort of legislation in place to protect people. What else is the British Beauty Council doing to help with this sort of stem the tide
Yeah, I
of
mean,
this discussion with fillers and Botox at such a young age? Because it plants the seed that aging is this sort of toxic thing that you need to avoid at all costs. Like,
yeah, I mean, the weird thing is that there's two parts to that. One is about aging. So you think like young people in their, like, I would say those are more in their late 20s are looking at Botox and fillers and stuff like that. I think laser treatments, laser facials are safe, and I think they're actually very, very helpful, useful, and do great work. I think that's quite amazing. That bit of it, I think, is very dangerous. But what we've done basically is we've managed to get Botox and fillers banned for under 18-year-olds. So that's really
amazing.
good. That was the first step. Now we're in a process with Department for Health and Social Care in terms of getting this bill pushed forward. Obviously, with a change of government, always very difficult because you kind of have to pick up where you left off, and
For
it's
sure.
challenging because there was a big consultation. We had record amounts of response from industry around the consultation. The idea is to have like a green is okay, orange is a little bit not sure about, and red was definitely we shouldn't be doing. And I feel that Botox and fillers should not be carried out by anyone without a medical license,
Agreed.
because there is no redress if something goes wrong. The fact of the matter is that the horse had already bolted before the Beauty Council came to fruition. So a lot of people are already doing that, carrying out those treatments. And so the best we can probably hope for is that if somebody without a medical license is doing that treatment, there is medical oversight on the premises, which I think again is really important. In terms of because redress is really important, because obviously if something does go wrong, we've got a big problem. Back to the other point about the young people getting those treatments, people in their late 20s, I think, are probably looking at aging. And like I said, I think there'll be machinery like lasers and other treatments that they can probably start to look at if that's a concern. I don't think it should be, but if that is a concern. I think that younger people getting it done, that's not about aging. That is about making your face look different. And that I am wholeheartedly against, because you have not grown into your face at that age.
No.
And having various different things done to your face to change how you look, having cheek fillers or chin filler or lips done at the early age of, in your early 20s, I think is appalling. Sorry.
We
And
don't know
I,
how these people are going
yeah.
to age. We don't know how that generation are going to then reach middle age with all of that all of those procedures, you know, having done, because they don't, they're not like the likes of these reality stars that are billionaires that can go and have things corrected and have fillers removed properly. They can't afford the best surgeons in town.
Not a single person I know that's had it done at that age that has not regretted it at 10 years later. And look, and I'll be really honest here, part of my sort of issue with it is my mum was a big fan of plastic surgery. And we're talking like my mum had plastic surgery in the 70s when it was like, she might have been the first person to ever have had certain things done, in the UK. I mean, she was a real
Very
early
brave.
adopter, very brave, but she was never satisfied. And she was never happy. And you're chasing this rainbow, this pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. And I don't know. And I feel like it stems from insecurity, but it perpetuates insecurity. And the fact is that when you get to a certain age, as you just said, you feel more confident about yourself. You start to learn to live with yourself. And I don't dislike the fact that maybe my nose is a little wide or my top lip is a little thin, or I don't really
Yeah.
care anymore because it's not really, life's really not about that.
No.
So I don't know. I think that there should be, I think there needs to be some sort of psychological or at least some basic assessment before somebody has a treatment. And I feel that there needs to be medical oversight if anyone is performing one of those treatments that is not a registered medical professional. And I also think that it's a big challenge in terms of distribution because botulinum toxins, that they're not, then they shouldn't be used by anyone that's not a medical professional, but clearly they are being used. So there is obviously a sort of distribution issue. Did I say that right? Botulinum toxin. Anyway,
I'm not a patient.
I don't want to use it by its brand name because that is just Botox is a brand name. It's not actually what it's called.
No.
But the fact is that there's obviously some slightly dodgy distribution going on because no one should be using it that's not a medical professional because it's a prescription drug.
Yes, and you're literally like injecting poison into your face. Like, why would you go with somebody that isn't medically
Yeah. I mean, I've
qualified?
never had fillers. I mean, and oftentimes I look at friends of mine that have had it done, and obviously some in really brilliant ways and very subtle. And but I
Yeah, it's
just
very
really
subtle fillers, but yeah, just you can't really tell unless it's kind of.
well, I mean, it's that sort of like suck it up and see. I'm not really prepared to wait and to see what if it goes wrong. I could be that 1% that it just doesn't sit in the right place. I'm terrified of something happening that I can't control. I don't know. I just wouldn't
Sure.
trust. I've got a real issue with trust, obviously, but yeah.
It's impacting the beauty industry in a way because people are jumping to immediately getting injectables and fillers rather than embarking on like a good skincare regime, for example. As soon as people think, oh, I'm in my late 20s, I should start thinking of an anti-aging routine, they immediately jump to injectables. The
I'm
industry.
hoping, I think it's become cheap, and I think that that's a problem. I think that it's become a bit cheap. I really hope that there's two things, like I said. One is if you're looking at anti-aging, there are certain resurfacing techniques with laser and, actives and skincare that probably are better than Botox and fillers, in my opinion. And a good regime and a good facialist that uses laser, I think, probably is a better option. I think when it comes to fillers, you only need fillers when you lose volume. And the fact is, you don't lose volume at the age of 20. So if you're using fillers at that age, it's not anti-aging. It's because you want your face to look different.
And people are using them for sort of facial restructure as opposed to just adding volume. Because it's an easy sort of alternative to a facelift. You can just come in, get a few injections, and then, have it done on your lunch break as opposed to.
But you've got to be damn sure that that person knows what they're doing. I mean, again, I just wouldn't trust somebody. I mean, the amount of times I've been offered something like that and I've gotten to the front door and I've thought, do you know what? I don't really want this. And I've walked away. But I think that, what I can only hope for with the British Beauty Council is that the consultation continues and that we get some benchmark for quality of service because What happens is the cheaper the procedure, the less qualified the practitioner, the less professional we look as an industry overall. And that's what I'm concerned about is I want to professionalize the industry. If it means that we have to do some sort of licensing scheme or whatever it might land at, I'm not sure, but I would like to make sure that we're professionalized. And I think that there isn't really many beauty therapists that I know that don't want to see that. So I think that if we have to, and also that means that those treatments should be more expensive, they should be harder to get, you know, they should it just shouldn't be on every street corner. I mean, I know on the Archway Road, there is a flipping barbers with a sandwich board outside offering fat loss injections. How is that possible in our country? You know? And I've seen it on Instagram
Scary.
where I've seen like they've been offering like Botox and fillers. I'm sorry, that's a barber shop on the Archway Road. What the hell are they doing? That's just not acceptable to me.
Definitely. It's kind of dystopian in a way, if you think
It
about it.
really is. It really is. I mean, we do have to put a stop to it. Anyway, I guess the thing is that what I would like in an ideal world, I would like there to be some sort of licensing scheme. I would like there to be some sort of medical oversight on the premises in case something goes wrong. I would like to see a register where there can be some redress if something does go wrong, where people are stricken off if they continually practice badly. I mean, look at that Brazilian bum lift situation that
Oh my
happened.
gosh.
A woman died. I mean, it's just horrendous. You know, we shouldn't be getting to that point.
No,
So
apparently not.
there has to be some halt. And also, I think we should start looking at, you know, what lasers can do because they're relatively safe. The companies that lease or sell them to beauty practitioners give very, very good training. I think there's a lot that can be done with a laser that
For sure.
we should start adopting and being more positive about and sort of opening that up a little bit because I think that in combination with a good skincare regime can do a lot.
No, I agree, but there's so much sort of misinformation about lasers sort of floating around, and it's really difficult to sort of regulate the kind of information that gets disseminated, especially with, like, you know, I think I read something recently about how, like, LEDs, there was a study that LEDs didn't work or something like that, or it was just a gimmick. And it's just, you know, there are sort of studies that show that there is kind of some sort of science behind it, and there are kind of proven results from it. So what I'm asking is, like, how do you sort of try and tackle that, the amount of sort of wrong information that is abundant
I
on?
mean, it's very difficult to do that because of social media. I mean, what we do, and we're very, very, and I am very strict with this. We don't put anything out that's not factual. So you know, I sort of always say to people, we're a bit like Switzerland, where we take no sides. Everything's a fact. We can't, as the British Beauty Council, it's really very important to us that there is no misinformation. I learned that very quickly during COVID that there were a lot of sort of Facebook groups or, you know, people on social media saying a lot of nonsense about what was going on. And I just said, look, if there's one thing that we can do, one thing that we need to do is make sure that everything that we're saying is absolutely factual, whether that be data driven or around aesthetics or ingredients or whatever it might be, it has to be fact. And that, you know, you come under a lot of criticism. You know, when we did that report, Courage to Change, about sustainability, and I had a lot of people kind of contacting me saying, you know, don't put this report out, it will kill the industry. And I'm like, we've got to tell the truth.
Really, why did they think it would kill the industry?
Because obviously there is a real problem with our reliance on plastic, but we know that. We can't bury that information. It is a fact. So say it, and then the cat's out the bag, and we as an industry then have a responsibility to fix it and do something about it. So that's what we work towards. Not saying we have to fix it overnight, but we have to
No.
do something about it. And so I think that oftentimes I think we're an industry that has relied on myth and misinformation for a very long time. We use terminology that is incorrect or is used as marketing. And even back to when I had Ruby and Millie, I remember when we were de designing Ruby and Millie, and I said, I want all the packaging to be clear and I want to show what's in a product. And somebody said to me at the company that was developing the products, going, but then people will know how little there is in the pack. And I was like, well, then people will see that everybody has too much bloody packaging. I don't care. Let
Yeah.
them see how much product is in the pack. And they were like, oh no, you can't do that. You can't show what's inside. It was just astounding to me. Like, this is the
Crazy.
problem with our industry. We're conning people. They
Do you
buy a
think
big bottle and there's a
yeah.
tiny little bit of, stuff inside it. That's ridiculous.
And then things like dummy ingredients. So like a company will advertise like the ingredient on the front of the pack when really they've got a small amount in the formula that does nothing, just so they can
Exactly.
legally say, oh, this is a keratin shampoo, even though the
Or
keratin
it's the
is not in it.
hyaluronic acid thing, isn't it? I
Exactly.
mean, you know what? Unless you've got like something under eight ingredients, let me tell you, the amount of hyaluronic acid in that product is minuscule.
I'm
Because if
sure.
you, I always look at that whole ingredient diet thing. So when I look at the back of a product, the fewer ingredients that are listed on the Inkey list, the better I think the product is,
Yeah, it's
because
like
it's
going to
not.
a restaurant. If they only cook like five, four or five things, you know it's going to be good. Whereas,
Yeah,
like, yeah.
exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Do you think that there's so much smoke and mirrors because it's predominantly women who are buying these products and the way we've historically marketed to those women using very patronizing, infantilizing language, which is hopefully that's why I set up Smart Beauty to try and change that and help brands communicate with their customers in a more sophisticated and informative way rather than, oh, this is like a magical cream or this is a miracle shampoo or whatever, and using these sort of very childish terminology without actually telling the consumer what's in the product. Because some like products
Yeah,
that are quite spoiled.
I think it's actually more of a misogynistic, sexist thing, and I don't want to
Yeah.
come off all feminist, but I am a bit. But I think that's because, and we just did this study with this report that we did, a beauty industry that looks like you, and no surprise, obviously, but white people and male and men increase at board level, whereas every other characteristic decreases at board level. So you've got a lot of men making decisions, and when men speak to women, or when they're selling something to women, they're going to pick up on the sort of, again, the insecurities of women. I mean, look, it's like almost human nature that we prepare ourselves to be attractive to men, as females, majority of females, let's say, not all,
There's kind of
but
nothing wrong with that in and of itself. I don't
no.
think.
And I do, but that is the relationship between a man and a woman. Men have to look a certain way to be sort of virile to women, and women have to be a certain way to look like they're going to be able
Yeah,
to,
and men are under pressure, as
yeah.
well.
Men are under pressure in a completely different
Yeah.
way. But I think that when men are marketing products to women, there is a certain language that they use that makes us feel
Yes.
insecure, inferior, and needing of the product. And I'm not saying those products, because my theory is that I think those products actually make me feel good. So I actually don't really care what they're called, but I do actually like the way they smell, feel, and make me feel. And so I like to think I don't buy them based on the narrative, because I think a lot of times it's sort of a falsehood.
Yeah.
But having worked in the medium of this fine industry for a very long time, I do know that it makes me feel good to put a little bit of AHR cream on my lips.
Oh,
I
exactly.
don't care what it's called, don't even really know what that means. But but I do think that that's quite misogynistic, actually, the way that terminology is. I mean, you probably know, because as somebody that writes a lot of copywriting, a lot of male products are the same as female products. It's just copywriting on the front of the pack is slightly
Yeah, was it the
different.
pink tax or something it's called, isn't it?
Yeah,
Like
so that they're
phrases, for example.
writing something for a woman, and then you take the same product and you can write it for a man, and you can stick one in a black bottle and maybe make it smell of sandalwood, and you can put one in a pink bottle, smell of rose, and but it's the same damn product
Yeah.
actually at the end of the day. So
Yeah. But
it
charge
is,
twice the price for the women's
and
product.
absolutely. And the other thing is that our industry is incredibly gendered, which is, and it's very binary, and I
Yes.
find that quite frustrating. That's not something that we're going to change overnight. It
Right.
is something that there are so many stakeholders that are involved in that, whether that be brands and retailers and stuff like that. It's the way it's been for years. You go to a hairdressing salon or you go to a barber's. It depends whether you're male or female,
Yeah.
for the most part, just saying, for the most part. But
Things are
yeah,
starting to change, like the perfume industry, for example. We're moving away from that for him and for her with the rise of niche and the rise of like gender neutral. Sense. So
And hair
that,
salons are changing.
yeah.
Sometimes it's like, why is a men's haircut cheaper than a women's? Or, why is that? Haircut's a haircut. I know Trevor Sorby's put in this sort of gender neutral, sort of non-gendered pricing structure. So I think there are some changes.
I mean, with
I
that,
think,
I just assumed that men had shorter hair and they need to get their hair cut more often. But yeah, that might be that
yeah, maybe. But the
it's
fact is that I used to be a hairdresser, and I have to tell
yeah.
you that men's hair is really bloody difficult because it's that, So yeah, I don't know. I think there's a lot that needs to change. Again, do you know the one thing I've learned about the British Beauty Council is you can make, you have to have small, you have to celebrate small wins because there are small things that you can
For
do.
sure.
Because everything takes a really, really long time. You're trying to basically, you're on a jet ski and you're trying to stop the Titanic from heading for an iceberg. And it's really challenging. And I've been doing that. Ruby and I used to say that when we had Ruby and Millie. I mean, we've been doing it for a very long time. And it's, you have to, and I have a lot of respect for a lot of those larger companies. It's very, very difficult for them to make changes, but a lot of them are doing actually a lot more than you expect them to be doing.
No, definitely. And now, like more indie brands are popping up where that is embedded into their DNA to be sustainable and to have all these values like, inclusion and diversity, that it's not kind of, they're not scrambling around trying to turn the ship around.
I do think that, I think we're becoming more honest. I think we're becoming more transparent as an industry. I think in the UK we do it far better than our other countries in terms of transparency and giving people agency to make those decisions. I think we're much better at it. I think we've got a much better and stronger cohort of people that want natural beauty products that are made with integrity and ethics. I think that, I was talking to Charles Denton from the Body Shop yesterday, and he was saying oftentimes the what the pace at which they operate is slightly slower because of the integrity that's built into the brand, making sure that supply chain is checked and that things are carried out in an ethical manner. And he was saying something that I didn't actually know, that when actually Anita Roddick sold the business and L'Oreal took it over, that part of what was sold was she built in that they maintained that integrity
I heard
and
that as
they
well.
stuck with it the whole time throughout their ownership of that brand. And because that was part of the deal. And I think that, I think that we shouldn't sell ourselves short. I think oftentimes we look at America or Europe and we think, oh, we like them, but we're not always like them. We don't use as many marketing buzzwords. We're, I think we're a little better. I really do believe that.
And at the end of the day, I think consumers vote with their feet, don't they? The more informed and sophisticated we become in our kind of buying choices, which I think a lot of people are, the more we're going to move away from brands that try and market to us the old-fashioned way, where it's all like smoke and mirrors. And brands will catch on as well because they'll see that we're not buying into that anymore. So it can be an organic change as opposed to something we need to necessarily rally against.
You saw we talked about sort of bad brands jumping on the bandwagon, but if the bandwagon is something that's good, who cares?
As long as they're doing it genuinely,
As long as
authentically,
they're
I
doing it,
guess.
yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't even care what their reason for doing it, but if brands decide to get rid of the plastic cellophane, right, around a box because they think that that is jumping on a bandwagon, and by not having that cellophane, their products are have less plastic and it's cheaper for them to produce. I don't care why they do it, just do it. No, it's not. So I think that sort of sometimes we have to celebrate those things,
Definitely.
even if it is just it's a commercial. That's what I was saying about our industry. Like we do have to sort of, I think we have to stop condemning the commerciality of things because I think sometimes we condemn people for making money. That's a very British thing. I think the Americans celebrate that a bit more, whereas, well, given the election, obviously, clearly they
Oh, for
do.
sure.
But I think that in a nice way, I think we have to be able to sort of get past that sort of where we condemn people for making commercial decisions. I think we sniff it out. I think, well, I always say there's two types of brands. There's sort of trend brands and legacy brands. And generally the legacy brands are the ones that stand the test of time and the trend brands are the ones that go in and out. Trend brands usually have a very, very weak backbone, weak ethics, weak
Like flash in the
story.
pan, kind of.
They don't last long. And we out and then they go.
But going from the teenage market to the menopause market,
Yes.
I wonder if we could talk about that for a second, because obviously it's valued at globally, I believe at 15.4 billion. Yet a lot of women in this bracket still feel unsupported by brands. I mean, how do you think that we can sort of better cater to the needs of these women who are going through?
Well, I mean, again, it's a trade-off, isn't it? It's like sort of, do we market to these women and use the fact that they're going through menopause to just flog them another product? That worries
Don't
me.
need. Yeah.
So that did worry me when this all sort of came up about 5, 6, maybe a bit longer years ago, when a lot of brands were starting to turn some of the marketing around the products that they had already sold to women of a certain age around the menopause. Like, I'm glad we talk about it,
Same.
but I think that there are some products that are being marketed to a particular psychographic, because I think the demographic is kind of slightly limiting of a term, because obviously you can have menopause at 40 or 60 or whatever. And I think sometimes, well, actually, because you can have different I have some friends that have gone through menopause without any medication at all. Some people that really struggled with it. Like, it's so varied. So the thing is that I'm a little bit cynical about marketing skin products to people with menopause, because yes, your skin does get drier, but just use a really good moisturizer. Like, you don't have to have menopause on the front of it to tell me that that's a product that I should use. I just need a really good moisturizer. The hair thing is slightly more worrying, in that I do actually think there needs to be more research done on what is a good hair product for someone with menopause. Because one of the reasons why I went on HRT is because my mum and my grandmother didn't, and they lost a lot of hair, and both had very thin hair. My aunt, who did go on HRT, kept her full head of hair. And I remember when I was coming up to that sort of period in my life when I was in my sort of late 40s, and I was thinking, when I get to that point, I'm definitely taking the HRT. I want my hair to remain thick, because I think both my grandmother and my mum, who didn't take it, lost their hair. So I actually think, sure, I get really dry skin. At night, I have to put Weleda bloody skin food on my. I didn't mean Weleda bloody skin food, but I mean bloody. I have to put it on my feet.
Yeah.
I have to put it on my feet, otherwise my feet itch all night. I get like itchy, like it's really frustrating. But Weleda skin food is an amazing product that doesn't need to say menopause on the front of it.
It doesn't, but does it feel nice to feel acknowledged in that way, rather than, historically, obviously brands have just marketed a product for like the 20 something market. Is it nice to kind of just feel like a little bit seen in that sense?
You know, the weird thing is that I feel like I'm invisible everywhere anyway. I think you just have to embrace the invisibility in a lot of ways sometimes. Times as a woman of a certain age, you're going through, I could nick stuff in a shop, no one would ever catch me, because no one ever looks at me when I walk into the shop anyway. I don't know. I think that's a really multi-nuanced question, because I don't want people to talk about it all the time, because whilst I'm really quite happy that there is greater conversation about it, I want there to be greater conversation about it, because I want the medical professional that I go to see to
That's the
understand
point.
what I'm
Yeah,
going through.
that's what I was kind of
Yeah.
driving at. That the more we
Right.
talk about
So
it, the more it's going to have that trickle down effect.
I think that's more around the medical and wellness thing. I think that when it gets into the cream that I buy, then I think I start to feel it's a little bit much, in that when I first started feeling symptoms of menopause, and I didn't know, I felt the symptoms, I couldn't sleep, I was having hot flushes and all that kind of stuff. I kept going back to my doctor saying something wrong, something wrong, something wrong. For about 2 years, I probably went 5 times, and nobody helped me at all, until I actually, Nadine Baggett came into my office and said, listen, this is what's happening, this is what you need. I literally went to my doctors the next day and I said, right, so I've spoken to someone that knows what the hell they're talking about, and this is what they told me I need, so I'd like a prescription for this and this. And it was game changing, absolutely game changing. And now every time I feel a slight symptom, I know more about it, so I know to go back. So I know just to go back, so I
Glad
changed
we
the
have to do our own
cream.
research like that, though, isn't it? It's just
I mean, it's bizarre, because they doctors knew nothing. Didn't matter whether they were male, female, 50, 60, or 20, made no difference. So yes, I feel that we as a beauty industry have done a lot around getting the message out there, and really helping to support women across the country in recognizing the fact that there's not something wrong with you. You are just going through a period of your life where your body reacts in a certain way to hormone balances. That's just what it is. All my friends have varying different experiences, and we're all on varying different cocktails of medication, and some are off it, and some never even went on it, and all kinds of stuff. The skin issue is less of an issue than the hair issue. And I think that we market and we sell more around the skin issue in a way than we do around the hair issue.
I mean, with the rise of scalp care, hopefully that's gonna start to
Yeah.
change.
Thinning hair. I think people's hair thins, and I think that that is a that's you know, I mean, mine has a bit, but I'm just surprised that brands in the hair care game aren't having more of a conversation around the thickening of one's hair for the base for people with menopause. That's what I mean. It's like I feel like certain businesses have adopted are using it in order to reframe products for women of a certain age, but I don't think the hair market's caught onto it as much as they could.
And if a brand is sort of looking to enter the menopause care market, what main advice would you give them?
Well, again, just don't market something because you think that, oh my God, we're struggling. Do some research, find a solution. Only now are we starting to hear, and I'm only reading things in the news about male pattern baldness. What about female pattern baldness? Who's doing that research? I worked for a guy called Shu Uemura. Mr. Uemura had said to me back in the mid-80s that women would start to lose their hair like men because of the stress that they were under, with the increased presence in the workplace and with the hormone imbalance that they that and the increase in life expectancy. And he's absolutely right. He
Oh,
was right there,
definitely.
right now.
We're told we
He's
could have it all. We're bloody doing it all. That's what's
yeah,
going to happen. We're digging
exactly.
ourselves into the ground.
Exactly. And I think that so I do again, I think that that is the thing. What I don't want to see is a brand go, here's our cream, this one is for this one it does what it does, but here's one for menopause and it's exactly the same thing. Do you know what I mean? I just feel like that's where I start to get a bit annoyed.
We're almost at the end of our time, but I know you said about creating, like celebrating the small wins are important, but if you could see one major change in the beauty industry, what would it be?
I would like to see more women, more people of color, more people from the LGBTQIA community, more people with neurodivergence at the around the board table, around the boardroom. I'd like to see people like me sitting around the table and not, and I think that's very important. I think career progression is really important because I think we'll have a much better industry. I think the trickle down effect of having multi-ethnic, multi gender, multi, just people from a wider group of characteristics sitting around, more people with physical disabilities sitting around the table.
Definitely.
I think we won't better ourselves as an industry until the people at the top come from a variety of different backgrounds where they can have constructive conflict around a table, so that what lands on our shelves represents the world better, in a better way,
Well, hopefully attitudes are changing, slowly but surely.
really hope so.
We've come to the end of our time, but thank you so much, Millie, for joining me and for your insights. It's been so lovely chatting with you, and hopefully we can
So
welcome
much.
you again soon.
Lovely to chat.
I hope you enjoyed that episode. All links will be in the show notes, and feel free to visit smartbeautycreative.com or visit us over on Instagram to find out more about what we do. And if you enjoyed listening, please don't forget to rate and review Smart Beauty on iTunes, as it helps people find us. See you next time.